KYW News Radio Original Podcasts. From KYW News Radio 103.9 FM, this is Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you. Presented by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org.
Hello, I'm Raquel Williams. Welcome to Bridging Philly. Children First, the leading advocate for children and families in the Commonwealth, has announced a new initiative uniting Hispanic stakeholders to address the unique needs of Philadelphia's Hispanic children and teens. It's called Palante and is the first study of its kind by the organization focusing on Hispanic children. I talk with the Deputy Director of Operations and a board member from Children First to learn more.
If we care about the future of Philadelphia, we have to do more in this space.
Charity Howard gets a peek at the fashions from the film Sinners at the AAMP.
What you also get to do is use the costumes to have this journey in the Black imagination.
All of that is coming up on Bridging Philly. Children First is a leading advocate for children and families in the Commonwealth, and it's announced a new initiative uniting Hispanic stakeholders to address the unique needs of Philadelphia's Hispanic children and teens. The initiative is called Palante, and it's named for Children First's recent report, which for the first time offers an analysis of Hispanic children in the city. Joining me to discuss this initiative is Brian Wang, Deputy Director of Operations for Children First, and Heidi Ramirez, who sits on the board. So I guess my first question would be, what motivated Children First to launch the Palante Initiative?
Children First is one of Philadelphia's longstanding children's advocacy organizations for more than 45 years. We've been fighting for kids' needs and their access to high-quality education, childcare, and healthcare. We saw in the data in recent years that Hispanic people in Philadelphia are the largest growing demographic group here in the city of Philadelphia. And at the same time, we didn't think that the city and stakeholders related to education, healthcare, early childcare had a unified strategy to, meet the needs. And so, we thought it would be helpful to look and kind of dig into the data to see what outcomes were looking like for Hispanic youth in the city of Philadelphia, and use that information that you saw in the Palante report as a way to kind of bring people together to start a conversation about, what the state of affairs is and what more could be done.
Yeah, I would just add that, Children First is about particularly advocating for children who aren't as well served as they ought to be. Right, particularly children at the margins of whatever. And it does extraordinary work for children of color, high poverty children, children involved in the judicial system, et cetera. So it's no mistake then that you'd look at the data and also say, in particular, what is or should be true for Latino children in Philadelphia. And as a starting point, making sure people are well aware of who we are as a community, what our needs are, and probably most importantly, what our assets are, many of which are not being tapped because we are being underserved.
Curious, what does Palante mean?
Onward, forward, como adelante. What we want to do is now move forward. Given this, what will we do differently if we are truly committed to all children in Philadelphia?
Okay, understand. So let's talk about the rapid growth of Philadelphia's Hispanic population, and that includes about 70,000 children. I'm sure it's shaped the urgency of the work that you guys are doing. So what gaps or unanswered questions led you to conduct this analysis of Hispanic kids in the city? And what were some of the surprising things that you found?
Well, I will say I'm entirely biased. So you should know that at the front end, that I work, in my own life as an educator, and I'm in the community. And what we notice most are the incredible assets of this community, right? I see children on the streets in Philadelphia all the time who are inadvertently acting as interpreters for their families, right? Children who are truly bilingual. So I always say to kids, I'll stop them and say, you've got the superpower. And they are shocked to know that, and that they know how to work across cultures, right, and across communities. We have all of these talents, all of these wonderful skills, and yet when you do look at a lot of these data, you see that we are certainly not where we need to be in terms of college readiness and access. And if you sort of go all the way down the line of opportunity, even beginning with early childhood, we don't have the quality of care and access to the quality that is necessary. So the idea of figuring out how can we do more to understand the gaps in opportunity and the resource gaps that exist so that we can tap each child's superpower. whatever those are, linguistic, cultural, the incredible talents our kids and families have. And it is not for a lack of engaged community members or a lack of engaged, you know, focused parents who really want the best for their children. So what is it? And what can we as a city do differently?
And if anything, you know, when you look at the report we wrote back in 2024, I mean, we highlight the engagement of parents as a strength. And I think, you know, what we really call on is for the institutions of the city, you know, to meet them with culturally appropriate and relevant materials, you know, by making sure things are developed in several languages to be able to be accessible to those parents. I mean, parents are engaged. They're there. They want to do more for their kids. And I think it's up to the systems that serve kids in Philadelphia to kind of match that enthusiasm and help harness it and bring people, as we said, Palante, forward.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about parents' involvement and the fact that they're really engaged. The report shows that Hispanic families are actually enrolling their children in early learning programs at higher rates. It really does say a lot about the commitment and opportunity at the same time when it comes to Hispanic families.
And they're looking for high quality schools for their children. They're thinking ahead about what opportunities. And unfortunately, they're not being met with the kind of resources. So when it comes to access to college ready courses, right? Algebra 1, AP, you know, the number of counselors per school, all of those things. Latinos, like many other families, but particularly Latino and African-American families, are left well behind.
Yeah, speaking of that, and the Hispanic public school students not on grade level in math or English, I believe it's about 70% or so. What would you say are some of the systemic issues that are going on? What kind of drives that academic gap?
We know that both high poverty children, children of color in Philadelphia are less likely to have a qualified teacher, are more likely to have larger class sizes, less likely to have access to rigorous coursework, technology, et cetera. And we can see this across the board. There are very few educational resources where Latino children and children of color more broadly have equitable access. And at the same time, we know that some of our families need even more support, right? As Brian suggested, what do we need to do to make sure families for whom language is a challenge? What do we need to do in neighborhoods that are particularly more challenging in terms of safety? What do we need to do? But folks haven't been asking that question and haven't been asking that question in a way that we're actually focused on answers.
Okay, so what do we know about any health barriers for Hispanic families and children that are actually uninsured? Where do we stand there?
You know, we note in the press release, 10% of Hispanic children are uninsured. And we also note that half of all Hispanic kids likely haven't seen a dentist in a year. So, you know, oral health is important, too. You know, those are gaps. I think, you know, we'd call upon the folks who administer CHIP to find, you know, a coordinated strategy to connect with and enroll those kids. And I'm sure, you know, in today's climate, there's perhaps, you know, some sensitivity around connecting with kind of public officials, given sort of the, you know, kind of temperature around immigration in this country at the moment. So, I mean, you know, that's kind of out there. I mean, I think when it comes to Palante and the initiative and what we're really looking to do is I think we want to convene stakeholders from the Hispanic community, you know, over the next year and, you know, really start to develop an agenda and a set of priorities for reaching that 10% of uninsured kids and to get them access to the healthcare that they need to thrive. Similarly for oral health as well. I mean, Heidi, I don't know if you want to say more.
Just, I mean, we know there's a very explicit relationship between early childhood health care and early childhood learning, right? And then we know for sure that quality early learning is going to affect our students throughout.
Did the report reveal anything about the differences within the Hispanic community? For example, the Puerto Rican community, the Dominican community, Mexican, Central American, and how the needs may vary within the community?
Yeah, I think we called out, first of all, the diversity of Philadelphia's Latino or Hispanic community, for sure. And that's diverse, certainly by national origin, as you're suggesting, by the geography across the city, by recency, if you will. You know, we often talk about Latinos and people immediately talk about immigrants, but the majority of Latinos in Philadelphia are native born. Right, and have been for generations in many cases. So you have all of those kinds of diversity in addition to linguistic, right? Both the, you know, some of us are, you know, raised speaking English, others Spanish as a first language. As I said before, many for whom biliteracy and bilingualism is the starting point. And then certainly with the increase of Central American immigrants, we're seeing a greater mix even of other languages, indigenous languages. Not everyone speaks Spanish, which is sort of a myth for folks among Latinos as well. So while we didn't get into, we recognize that diversity as presenting its both opportunities and challenges, most of the data sets we have don't tease that out. And I think that's another important point. This is talks about the lack of attention to Latinos, treated as a monolith, left outside, and not then sort of, what would it look like if we looked at even just first gen versus native born? What would it look like if we looked at students for whom biliteracy is an asset? All of these kinds of things. And yes, how are the needs different for North Philly Boricua and South Philly Salvadoreño or Mexicano, right? And folks who've been here for 30 years and three generations versus children who are just arriving. So all of that requires more attention and support and deserves, right? If we want to serve our children well, we should know who they and their families are.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you.
Okay, so let's get right into the action plans of Palante. I'm kind of interested in knowing who is involved in this and who from the community is actually going to be coming together to put these action plans into place.
Well, it's an evolving process because we keep trying to, as they say, broaden the tent, if you will. There are lots of incredible Latino-serving organizations in Philadelphia, and we are, you know, proud and honored that many of them are sort of working with us. But also we're recognizing that because this is such a changing community, we want to make sure we're tapping into that evolving community. So there are a couple pieces of this. There is the Palante Fellowship, right? We really strongly believe there are more leaders of and with us than are publicly recognized often, or even people who recognize themselves as leaders. And so part of this effort has been about tapping into emerging leaders. And those folks come from all across the city, young professionals, moms, et cetera, from across the city. And again, to your point around diversity in terms of how they identify as Latinos. So that's the fellowship itself. And part of the work they have engaged with our partners in Strategy Arts and the larger Palante team is to conduct interviews and engage folks from across the city. So all of the groups you might imagine we are trying to tap into, as well as a lot of others who maybe don't think of themselves as Latino organizations, but who actually are really active in serving them. And then sort of the other piece of this engagement is to have broader community conversations where we'd be inviting folks from across the city in particular neighborhoods and pockets to come in and just share and talk. You know, what are they seeing and noticing in the report? What did we miss? What should we focus on more now? What are the questions do we have, and how can we together draft a broad agenda to, again, move us forward? Palante.
Got it. Understand. So with all of these conversations that are going to be taking place, I'm wondering what the top priorities for Palante are, especially in year one.
Well, you know, that's a great question, Raquel. And I think it's almost premature to say that we know what the priorities are right now. I think if you look at the Palante report, you know, we outline a series of steps and systems related to early childhood, K-12 education, and healthcare can take. You know, healthcare, we want to ensure all Hispanic children have comprehensive medical insurance, including children without citizenship documentation, increase children's access to mental health, dental, and vision care. But really, what we really want to do, our goal in convening stakeholders from across the Hispanic community, is come up with an agenda for Hispanic children that's really driven by those stakeholders from across the community. Like, step one is really bringing people together, looking at the systems that are serving children, and really kind of, you know, working with that group to kind of come to a consensus on what really should be prioritized right now. Should we start with early childhood? Should we start with K-12 education? You know, how fast, how soon, with what? You know, our goal is really to bring people together so that we can develop that agenda and prioritization.
What has been the response from the community so far? What's the reaction been to the creation of Palante and the plans going forward?
Well, I mean, I would say with response to the report itself, I think people were incredibly grateful to see this data all compiled in one place. You know, like, data is power in so many ways, and having the data brought together in a concerted and coordinated way can be a jumping off point to do so many things. I think there's a deep hunger out there to do more. And I think people have said, you know, we've seen the data for a while, but now it's time to act. We want to come up with this agenda. And I think, you know, when you reflect on the fellows that have come to the table as well, you know, I think these are people who are earlier in their careers who are incredibly ready to roll up their sleeves and be of service to their community. So, I mean, Heidi, what have you seen as you've talked to people?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. You know, for some of us, the data don't feel new, right? I'm in education. I've worked in this space for a long time. And so for some of us, it's almost heartbreaking to see them and sort of say, this hasn't changed much. And there's a set of folks for whom, gosh, we know all this and we haven't done anything. And to Brian's point, and are saying, thank goodness it's all in one place, right? You can't hide it in several little places and say, we don't know. Pulling this together should speak to, frankly, not just the Latino community, but the broader Philadelphia policymaking, child advocacy, education, health communities. It says, if we care about the future of Philadelphia, we have to do more in this space. And having it all there, sort of, what do they say? You have the receipts now? you know, there's something to it. For others of us, it is even more motivation because we have seen it. We know. Please help us do this important work. Engage with us because it's not happening yet in the way it needs to.
So tell me about those receipts. What do you plan to do with them when you sit and have conversations and come up with different plans? Are you planning on working with lawmakers or other people of that nature to kind of drive forward when you recognize what the problems are and come up with some possible solutions?
Part of being Latino-centered in the design of this work is that it is somewhat organic, right? We don't come into this saying children first or someone else has an answer, right? But rather, what do we think it should be? What should the approach be as a community, right? Coming together across all of our diversity and our strengths, how will we help drive this? So I don't have a here is the path, but let's also be clear. This is in partnership with Children First, who has an incredible record of, yes, driving policy change and advocacy and grassroots organizing. And we would be fools not to leverage that expertise on behalf of Latino children. And I would likewise say we have a host of children serving and Latino serving organizations who also know how to engage and get stuff done. So we're going to figure out how we do it as a community and, again, as broad as a community as possible.
And, you know, the notion that finally we are kind of ready to roll up our sleeves and kind of tackle this in a concerted way. Because like Heidi said, when you see all the data laid out comprehensively, it's no longer just a footnote in a report about K-12 education or about healthcare. It is a unified set of data about the community. And I think that really helps focus people's attention.
Okay, well, finally, looking ahead, what would you say the vision is for how the city can fully support Hispanic children so that they can thrive? A magic wand, if you will.
Well, you know, I love thinking about the superpower of Latinos. We have so many strengths, and it's beyond our tacos and rice and beans, right? Philly loves the diversity of our food, and I do too. We're also, you know, there's a great report a week or two again about the power of immigrants in the city and Latinos being a share of that and how we contribute in our neighborhoods economically. So that people would start to acknowledge the power of Latinos and leverage it. What are these talents? How can we... You know, when you see a spark, you want to keep it lit. And so thinking about the ways that, you know, whether it's the school district of Philadelphia, you know, the foster care system, the healthcare system, that everyone is thinking about, we have this extraordinary group of children and families. What are we going to do to make sure they can be their best selves? And that includes being safe, healthy, happy, thriving, educated, and able to continue to contribute to the city's economy in a meaningful way. But also just the joy and beauty that is this city. You know, as we celebrate 250 years of this country, there is a really important role for Latinos in this. You know, we are Philadelphia, and we want to be part of that future, and folks see us as such.
Absolutely love that. How can people learn more about the report? Is there a place people can go to check it out and get more information?
Yeah, the report's up on Children First website, childrenfirstpa.org.
Absolutely. We invite everyone to join with us. Let's move forward together. There's a great opportunity here. And I'm very grateful to Children First for seeing this. I think it is not a small note that it is not a Latino-led organization that says this matters. And we should all take that as a reminder of what is right and good for the city right now.
Well, all I can say is it is about time. I'm so happy that this is being addressed. Thank you both, Brian Lang and Heidi Ramirez, for bringing this to our attention. I truly appreciate your time, and thank you so much for joining us on Bridging Philly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Raquel. Really appreciate you reaching out and bringing attention to this matter.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM.
Welcome back to Bridging Philly. Well, Charity Howard is getting a tour of the new Ruth E. Carter exhibition at the African American Museum in Philadelphia as they honor her Oscar-nominated work in the blockbuster hit Sinners. Let's get the latest now from Shara in the City.
This week on Shara in the City, we're feeling that Oscar buzz, and we're heading to the African American Museum of Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street to get a look at the Ruth E. Carter Afrofuturism in Costume and Design, a traveling exhibition, yep, that's the full title, where they shine a light on her 40-year career, her work with Spike Lee on Do the Right Thing, as well as Ryan Coogler's The Black Panther, and of course, the record-breaking film Sinners, as the film racks up a total of 16 Oscar nominations. And from what I hear, it's a lift you off your feet kind of powerful. So let's go get lifted. Oh boy, and right through the doors, you already feel that vibe. Now we got to find Dr. Michael Wilson. He's going to give us the 411. Now he's got all the answers. And we're walking up, we're walking. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? My name is Dr. Michael Wilson. I'm a curator here at the African American Museum in Philadelphia.
All right, and we're going to check out something special today.
Yeah, so we currently have one exhibition, the Ruth E. Carter Afrofuturism in Costume and Design, which is a traveling exhibition. But here at AMP, we have the privilege of being the first institution to exhibit the Sinners costumes, and it is such a beautiful time to exhibit it is because Sinners is having a historic Oscar run.
The blow up, the buzz. You can hear it from here.
Absolutely. We actually just put these costumes back on exhibition is because we took them to a little tour. Over the weekend, they had a chance to travel to New York and they were with Ruth E. Carter while she was being interviewed on The View. So they're not just doing a historic Oscar run, they're doing a physical run.
And we get to see them first as they come back. I mean, this is pretty cool. Thank you for taking time today. So we're going to head up this ramp?
Absolutely. Let's go take a look at some other costumes.
And if you've ever been to AAMP, you know there's a ramp that connects the first, second, and third floors. Now, as you go up the ramp to the left, they've got a projection of Do the Right Thing. And then on the right, more of her work. And then at the very top of the ramp, you have the Sinners exhibit. This is really fantastic.
Yeah, this is a you have to be here moment because what's happening with the exhibition is you have an opportunity to celebrate Ruth Carter and, you know, her creative genius through costume and design. But then what you also get to do is use the costumes to have this journey in the Black imagination, how costume design is used to narrate actual events within African history, within African American history and culture. But with what's happening with Sinners and this historic Oscar nominations, now what you have a chance to do is have a discussion on a historic arc of Black filmmaking from Keenan Ivory Wayans and Eddie Murphy and Spike Lee, right, to Ryan Coogler, and create a foundation that Ryan Coogler gets to stand on with all of these great Black directors and Black actors, and how costume design really, you know, makes these people like alive in very dynamic ways.
It really does shine a light on so many aspects of culture, but also aspiration. You know, aspirationally, like, we have dreams. We have things that are outside of sometimes the mythology of what Black culture is, just the way in which we see each other.
Yeah, absolutely. If I had to make a statement on what the entire exhibition represents, it's that, you know, we are our ancestors, and it shows that in very, very clear ways.
Mm. Okay, show me some. Show me some. Let's go.
Okay. So one of the things that I like about the exhibition is that we get to look at costume design. So we get to look at the materiality of making, but we also get to look at some other artistic elements. So as we walk up the ramp, we get to see an artist who was commissioned to make several works, like Israel Solomon. And he's drawing on not only Ruth Carter's costume aesthetic, but, you know, creating some beautiful graphic design pieces that makes movies like Coming to America or Do the Right Thing alive in some dynamic ways. So
you really make it into a journey almost.
Yeah. And, you know, so before we even go into the galleries, when we walk up to the ramp, you have this 50-foot projection screen that is a video montage to Ruth Carter's career. And what I really like about the video is that there are no words, but what happens is that the costumes and the scene, they're activated in a way where you're drawn to the images, and you don't even have to hear what's happening, but you get to be really like stuck to what's happening just by looking.
Yeah. Right?
And it shows the power of costumes, because the costumes are supposed to animate, you know, a narrative. What the exhibition does also, it is it creates a really interesting nostalgic moment for people, because when you see a movie, like just like what you just said, just do the right thing. The movie takes you back to a place when you first saw it, right? What was happening?
Immediately, you remember copying
the way that Malcolm X and Spike Lee were walking, you know,
in those flipped up hats,
exactly, or the way, you know, I mean, Coming to America when you know hopping on one foot, like it takes you back in a really interesting way.
So a series of moments,
exactly. Then you end up running into being really present in a moment with what's happening with Sinners.
The moment you walk up, everything. I mean, it's just from head to toe. It is glamour, it is chic, but it's also history.
Yeah, the exhibition does multiple things. One, it shows Ruth Carter's genius when it comes to costume design. Yeah. But then it also gets to show her process. So there are sketches, there are swatches. So it's not just the end result, but the process. But the gown that we're looking at, where, you know, Ruth Carter won her Oscars for her creative genius. I love looking at this gown, because it's like, no, she wasn't just a genius, she was fly too. This stylist gown looking good, right? You get to celebrate Ruth as well. Right? She was like, I don't just make good costumes, like, look how I dress.
Right.
So I like it. And then you get to, you know, see her sewing machine, right?
That's amazing. My grandmother had one in the basement just like it. Yeah, used it every week.
I remember my mom's sewing machine. I remember getting my finger stuck in it because she told me not to touch it. Yeah, and my mother used to make my older sister's clothes, right? So I look at that sewing machine, and that brings back home, right?
It does.
But then when you look to the immediate left of it, you see a 3D printed sash. So when you talk about the evolution of technology and how Ruth Carter utilizes these dynamic technological features to create beautiful adornment narratives.
And the curation, you kind of lead one thing into the next, almost like a wave of, you know, history, of moments.
It's not just about movies. It's about the process of making, the process of imagining, and the process of narrating history and culture in really dynamic ways.
And then when we look at Sinners, whoa, I mean, it takes you back to the movie. You're in that club setting, and the room's dark, and the clothes are sharp, but also, got a moment of mystery.
Yeah, the Jew joint is my favorite scene. And, you know, as a curator and an art historian, Sinners gives you this artistic palette that you really get to paint beautiful stories for viewers with. So when you look at Smoke and Stack, you not only get to talk about their adornment and how their attitudes are reflected within, you know, the color choice and their outfits, but you get to have conversations about African art, history, and culture. Ryan Krugler was very interested in the Yoruba Iri Ibeji figures and the twin figures, and how their personalities can be activated within that aspect of the Iri Ibeji. You have Annie, who shows the way that African cultural retentions can transform from the Caribbean to the South within, you know, hoodoo practices. You know, a lot of us had those hoodoo aunties, right? And then in that juke joint scene, what it does is it activates everything from a Zoyoli dancer from to Memphis juking to break dancing to show how, no, the way that we express is on this beautiful cultural arc. And the movie as a whole draws from so many artistic elements like Ernie Barnes' Sugar Shack that we've seen in Good Times, right? But then also we can have conversations about August Wilson plays, like The Piano Lesson and using music to conjure the ancestors, right? Or Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, when people look, when they come and to try to take our music and culture, but what you do is you can now package that in the form of vampires. So it's not that it's a horror movie, but it uses creativity like horror to talk about historic events and cultural nuance within the Black experience.
It's a vehicle. It's a vehicle to really not just pass on the message, but also a lesson. You've got the burgundy hat that's fly, and then you've got the paperboy blue, and then you've got the suit with the red tie. Just like the movie, it's still, but it's moving. It's always moving.
The personality and the emotions come out, and at the same time, you can have conversations about, well, what did urban life look like in 1930s Chicago? And what does that transition to rural Mississippi look like, right? Right. And the costumes and the acting, right. You know, and it provides so much texture to really, like, feel that time period and that experience in those landscapes.
You can feel the crashing, and then you can hear the smooth ride. You know, it's so different in terms of the brothers, but so much the same.
Yeah, but you can almost taste the liquor.
Yeah, you can.
In a juke joint.
Smell that smoke.
Exactly.
Thank you for joining us. Bridging Philly is brought to you by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org. Follow me on Blue Sky at Raquel on Air. You can also follow Shara Day Howard on Blue Sky at Shara Day on Air. For Shara Day Howard and our producer, Sabrina Boyd-Circa, I'm Raquel Williams. Be well.